This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today I'm joined by two people, Dr. Caroline D'Angelo from the University of Leiden. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also a newcomer to the Jodcast, Alex Clark, who's going to hopefully be doing lots of interviews in the future.
Hi.
So welcome as well.
Thanks.
So Caroline's been here at JBCA giving a talk on transitional millisecond pulsars. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, could you give us an introduction to what it is that, well, where you work and what it is that you study and that sort of thing?
Yeah, of course. So I work right now in Leiden University, which is in the Netherlands. I'm originally from Canada, from Toronto, where I went to, I was born, raised there, and I went to university there. And then for my PhD, I came to Europe, actually. I did my PhD in Munich in Germany.
That's a long way, that is. So why did you decide to go to Germany?
Well, I was kind of bored of being in Canada, to be honest, and I was looking for an interesting new adventures, and I kind of applied to Germany on a whim, and then they offered to fly me to Germany and visit. So,
and they paid for it.
And they paid for everything. So I had never been to Europe, and I took them up on it, and when I was there, I really liked it. So then I moved there and did my PhD there.
Manchester should keep that in mind for recruiting other PhDs in the future. Yeah, cool. So you focus on neutron stars, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mostly focus actually on accretion, which I think we'll talk about. And what I've been mostly doing in the last few years is really studying neutron stars and how they evolve, what they look like, how we understand what the light that we see from them.
Can you tell us maybe just a quick overview of how you get a neutron star and properties of a neutron star?
Yeah, well, I think neutron stars, I'm a bit biased, but I think that they're pretty much the most exotic objects in the universe. So they're incredibly extreme in all possible ways. They form when you have a really massive star, so maybe 100 times more massive than our sun, runs out of fuel and it just explodes in an explosion called a supernova. And we see those from time to time. And at the end of the explosion, all you have left is this tiny speck of ultra-dense material about the mass of the sun, but it's only about the size of the city. So it's about 10, 20 kilometers across. But because it's so massive and so tiny, it has a gravity that's about 200 billion times stronger than the Earth's. So it's just a really extreme situation, a really extreme environment. And at the same time, because it's so dense and it evolved from a really massive star, the magnetic field of the massive star, so a fairly weak magnetic field, basically gets all jammed together into this tiny little object. So the magnetic fields that you have in stars like that are at least 10,000 times stronger than anything we could ever create on Earth. So you have this really tiny, dense speck of matter, huge gravity, huge magnetic field.
Mm. They're some of the most extreme objects in the universe, I guess, and they spin as well, don't they? They spin quite fast.
Yeah, so this is another extreme fact about them. You know, just like when you're skating, or you see somebody with their arms out and you suddenly pull in your arms and you go faster. The exact same thing happens with a neutron star. So you have this really massive star that then collapses, and as it collapses, it starts to spin much faster. So neutron stars can have incredibly fast spins. So typically a few seconds, but even as fast as, you know, they can spin up to 700 times a second.
And is that the limit of how fast that they can spin, theoretically? Like, what happens after that?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because if you make a theoretical model of how fast they could spin before they actually just broke apart, you actually find out that they could spin almost twice as fast as that. So that's a really interesting astronomical question, why they don't spin faster than about 700 times a second.
So 700 times a second, could you put that into context maybe, and just how fast, or what is that comparable to?
Well, I think it's actually a bit difficult to find things on Earth to compare that to. So one of the things I've thought about is 700 times a second is about less than 2 milliseconds, so 2/1000th of a second. And if you look at the electrical signals in your brain, so the time it takes for electrons to travel, or electrical impulses to travel across your brain, that's about 10 times faster than that. So basically, this thing spins around 10 times faster than you can think.
Wow.
So I think that's pretty, some kind of idea of how fast they are.
It's hard to get your head around that.
Yeah.
So in your area of study, you don't just study neutron stars that are on their own. You study them when they've got like a companion.
Yeah, that's right.
In what we call a binary system.
Yeah.
So as you said before, these neutron stars form in like dramatic explosions.
And yep.
How often does one keep its companion and not just blow it away when it explodes?
Well, that's a bit of a hard question to answer, actually. So a lot of stars that we see in our galaxy, just normal stars, actually have a companion to begin with. And we know that there's a lot of neutron stars that also have a companion. But really the reason, so we know that sometimes they do, even if they don't always do that. But the real reason to study them when they study neutron stars that are in a binary system, so with a stellar companion, is that they're just much easier, because sometimes if the companion is very, very close to the neutron star can actually rip off material from the companion, and that can fall onto the star itself. And that's a process called accretion.
How close are we talking here, these two objects?
Well, really close. So typically the stars that we study, which are accreting systems, have a neutron star, so this tiny little star, it's 20 kilometers across, and then a regular star, a little bit less massive than the sun, that's orbiting around it, you know, every 6 hours or so. So it's really a distance of about 100 times the radius of the sun. So 100 times bigger than the sun. Wow. Is large.
It's really quite close.
Yes. Yeah, it's really, really close.
So you study these binary stars which are tearing off matter from their companions and accreting. You gave a great talk, and you said that accretion is one of the most efficient engines in the universe because they're just really efficient at producing energy from this process of tearing apart matter and funneling it onto the star.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So accretion is the most, accretion onto an object like a neutron star that's so incredibly dense is the most efficient engine in the world, in the universe. And it's the most theoretically efficient engine. So, you know, when you think about if you burn a match or something, you get a bit of energy, and the most efficient engine we know, the most efficient energy, that we can make on Earth is like a nuclear explosion. Nuclear processes in the sun or nuclear bombs, but actually just accretion. So basically just a little bit of gas falling onto the surface of the star falls with so much energy that it actually releases more energy than it would in a nuclear explosion. So if you kind of think it, so accretion is not that hard to understand. If you just think about the way that gravity works on Earth. So if you take a watermelon, for example, to the top of a really tall building on Earth and you drop it, by the time it reaches on the ground, it's just going to smash apart. So that energy that it releases is really accretion energy. Now, if you do the same experiment on a neutron star and you just drop a watermelon, it's going to release a lot more energy than a nuclear bomb that would flatten a city.
And that's due to its incredibly strong gravitational
field.
That's
exactly, yeah.
Cool. And this produces really, really bright sources, which is why you can see them.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. So it's a really small object, but it's accreting and it's releasing so much energy that we can see them on Earth, even though they're, you know, hundreds of billions of kilometers away.
Okay. So in your talk, you were talking about this thing called Eddington.
Yeah.
And a bit about how there's a certain limit about the amount of brightness we can see from the matter accreting. Could you talk a little bit about that and what exactly you mean by Eddington?
Yeah. So the Eddington limit. So Eddington was a very famous English astronomer. And the Eddington limit was a theoretical idea that he proposed. Basically, if you imagine a star that's incredibly bright, like our sun, actually it's so bright that the light itself has a sort of pressure, so it actually starts pushing things away from it. So comets, for example, when they get very close to the sun, the tails start getting pushed away just from the light of the sun. But you can imagine that the brighter something is, the more pressure it has, the more light will push it away. So the Eddington limit is the limit where the rate at which you're adding material by accretion and releasing all this energy is balanced by the sun's ability or the star's ability to push it away. So it's this kind of balance. So you can't get any brighter than the Eddington limit in this simple picture.
So in your work, you talked a little bit about how some of these systems break that law, and actually they get a lot brighter than you would normally expect from the theory of Eddington.
That's right. So Eddington's idea was that you could never get brighter than the limit that he proposed, the Eddington limit. But actually, astronomers have now discovered for sure that some neutron stars, some accreting neutron stars, break that limit by about 100 times. So this is a very interesting discovery last year, not for me, but from other astronomers, that that you have a neutron star that you know is a neutron star because you can actually see it pulsing, which we'll explain in a minute, and it's really, really bright. So you know that it's a neutron star, but it's 100 times brighter than it should be. So that's...
Yeah, that's really quite something. So you mentioned pulsations there.
Yes.
Can we come to that and explain just exactly how does a neutron star pulse?
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, neutron stars have really strong magnetic fields, incredibly strong. And when they're accreting, what tends to happen is that as the accreting gas gets very close to the neutron star, it starts getting drawn along the lines of a magnetic field. So if you imagine like the magnetic field lines that you imagine in a permanent magnet, say, all of the matter starts to stream along the poles of the magnet, so the point where the lines all come together. So rather than see the light coming from everywhere, you're only going to see the light coming from really the pole of the magnet of the neutron star. So if that magnet, now you imagine the pole is kind of rotating around because the neutron star is spinning really fast, every time the pole sweeps in front of your line of sight, so it sweeps in front of the Earth, you're going to see it as a pulsar. So we actually detect most of the neutron stars that we see because we see them as pulsars. And that was discovered here, of course, at Jodrell Bank about 50 years ago.
Earlier you mentioned that neutron stars can get to, 100 times as bright as the Eddington luminosity. So that's incredibly bright. But actually, one of your interests is on the dimmer neutron stars. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So I think another way that neutron stars are so extreme is that not only do they get very bright, but the same star can suddenly drop by a million times, and it can become incredibly faint as well. And we don't really understand very well how that happens, why it becomes suddenly so faint and so quickly. So they can do this in over a month. So I'm really interested in investigating how this actually works and studying these neutron stars that are incredibly faint to understand what's going on.
And when these neutron stars go faint, how do you see them? Do they emit by a different mechanism, or do they emit different types of radiation?
So they can. So mostly, even when they're extremely faint, if they're close by, then you can see them with X-ray telescopes. So that's usually how we see them. So like I mentioned in my talk, even when they're very faint, you can detect them with X-ray satellites.
So in your talk, you talked about a specific object that you study called transitional millisecond pulsars. Could you talk a bit about what that means?
Yes, absolutely. So these are, even though all neutron stars are really exciting, transitional millisecond pulsars are especially exciting because they really represent a very important link between most of the pulsars that we see and the accreting pulsars. So, so most of the pulsars that we actually that we see in the sky are radio pulsars. So we only see them with radio emission, and there's no gas accreting onto them. And the fastest pulsars that we see that are spinning, up to 700 times a second, it's always been a mystery how they can spin so fast. So it was always thought that they spin so fast. We see them spinning so fast because they have been accreting a lot of gas, and that's been making them spin faster over time. But we never saw that happening. And then on the other hand, we have these very bright X-ray pulsars or X-ray sources that are also accreting and seemed to be the earlier stages of the radio pulsars. But finally, a few years ago, some astronomers in Canada discovered this source. The one that I talked about in my talk, called J1023, is our name for it.
Why is it called J? What do the numbers mean?
So J1023 plus 0038. All of these pulsars are always named with a convention of where they're found on the sky. So it tells
you. So they're basically just coordinates.
It's some kind of coordinate system. Yeah, usually according to the object, the telescope that discovers them. Right, so this source is really exciting because it was the first source ever discovered to actually switch from being an X-ray source, so an accreting source, to being a radio pulsar. And it made this switch several times now. So it finally represented the missing link between the radio pulsars that we see spinning very quickly and the accreting pulsars, and proved that one comes from the other.
How long does it spend in each sort of mode?
Well, so this is an interesting question, because so far we've only discovered a few of these sources. So there's only three transitional millisecond pulsars that are known for sure. But J1023, for example, which is the oldest one that we know, seems to switch between being a radio pulsar and an accreting pulsar every 5 or 10 years.
So here in Manchester, there's a lot of people who work on pulsars. I'm sure you're familiar with many of them. Have you worked with any of them in this work or in any other work?
So in this work, I haven't directly worked with them yet, but in Manchester, there is a lot of interest in this new type of source, these transitional millisecond pulsars, and some of the latest work on these sources is being done by people in Manchester.
Could you tell us a bit about what your main conclusions were from your talk and sort of the main results?
So I've been recently studying J1023 with the same observers who discovered it. And recently we found that in the accreting state, so when it's showing a lot of X-rays, we can actually learn a lot about the nature of the accretion flow. So it's one of these really faint X-rays, really faint neutron stars that we see, and we want to understand what was happening. So we know that J1023 is spinning really, really fast, about 600 times every second, almost. Mm. And it was always thought that when it's really, really faint, all of the gas that was trying to fall onto the surface of the neutron star would get flung away by the magnetic field. So if you imagine that the magnetic field is sort of this really fast spinning thing at the center of the, you know, surrounding the pulsar, surrounding the neutron star, whenever this little bit of gas would try to fall onto the surface, it would just get flung away by the magnetic field.
And therefore there'd be no accretion, and then there'd be no brightness, and that's why it's dim.
Right, yeah. Basically. Yeah. So the idea was always, when these were first discovered, is that none of the gas actually reaches the surface of the neutron star. So we never see any pulsations when it's bright in X-rays. But what was discovered is that actually we do see pulsations. And even though it's really, really faint, we actually do see pulsations, which means that some gas actually is getting onto the surface of the neutron star. And what I presented in my talk, the newest discovery, is that actually this tiny bit of gas that's getting onto the surface isn't actually changing the rate at which the star is spinning very much. So usually we think that over long periods of time, the gas that you get falling on is making the star spin much faster, or it can also make it spin slower. But in this case, in J2023, it's not actually changing the spin rate. And this is very exciting for me, because in particular, the model that we can use to understand this, the picture that we have, is one that I developed in my PhD work called a trapped disk. And it's essentially a way for low accretion rates onto the surface of a neutron star, even if it's spinning really, really fast.
And you call this the trapped disk.
That's right. Because you essentially, rather than flinging all of this material out when it reaches the magnetic field, instead you have this disk that stays very close to the neutron star and actually continues to be able to fall onto the surface.
And feed it. It must be quite rewarding to predict that and then, you know, many years later to finally observe and prove the work you've done before.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and it's really satisfying also to have a very good proof like this that it's not easy to find other explanations for how this is happening.
Yeah.
So that was quite satisfying.
And going into the future, what are you hoping to discover next? Or are you going to be looking at this source? Are you going to be looking for more of these sources?
Well, actually, so most of my work is actually theoretical. So I don't do a lot of work with radio telescopes or X-ray telescopes, for example. So one of the interesting questions that I'm hoping to look at next is exactly how the switch between radio and X-ray states in these things happens. So how does it actually go from not having an accretion disk, not having any accreting gas around it, to suddenly having gas? And trying to understand that from a theoretical point of view.
Cool. That sounds really interesting. Hopefully we'll be able to interview you again about that in the future.
I'd look forward to it.
Your next discovery, isn't it?
Next discovery, yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.